Where are you?
I am in New York. I am in Brooklyn.
Right. Okay. That's what I remember. Okay.
Yeah. And you're in Philly.
I'm in Philly.
All right. Well, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Another podcast about death. Like I said, so this episode is about the afterlife. And so to kick things off, if you could just introduce yourself and what you do and how that pertains to the afterlife.
Okay, I'm Simcha Raphael. I am a psychologist and a rabbi, and I have been investigating the whole question about what Judaism has to say about life after death for, at least three or four lifetimes. But in this lifetime, I've been working on this for a good 25 years. I've written a book called Jewish Views of the Afterlife, which is said to be the classic in the field. And in my counseling work with people, I have done a lot of bereavement work, helping people walk through the quote, valley of the shadow of death and wrestle with questions about death and loss, which invariably brings up questions about life after death and do I still stay connected with people. I've also worked in hospice and have helped people sort of on the journey out of here, the transition. And so my work is a combination of teaching, counseling, and writing on this rather relevant topic to people who deal with death and loss, which seems to be most people in life.
Well, let's get to it, because you said, you alluded to that possibly this is not your first go around in life. So it's interesting, because I grew up Christian. And so I find myself in this conversation trying to not use that as like the baseline context of the afterlife, meaning this coming into it with the idea of heaven and hell and good and bad and things like that. But I'm going to anyway, even though I try not to. So in relationship to Christianity and the idea of it seems as though they have a very tight script of what not only happens in the afterlife, but then the resurrection and that narrative. But what is, in Judaism, what is that relationship with heaven and hell? Or is there a relationship with heaven and hell?
Okay, well, let me start by clearing up a misconception out there. Many people, I've often heard that Jews don't believe in life after death, or that Judaism believes in life and the living. And it turns out that in the pre-modern period, before scientific rationalism and Enlightenment thinking and the major migration of Jews from Eastern Europe to America, in the old world, so to speak, in the world of Fiddler on the Roof, for example, the grandmother comes through and talks from the other side. In the world of the Kabbalistic masters of centuries ago, there was never any question that there is a continuity of consciousness after death. So the first statement is, yes, Judaism does believe in life after death, and we've lost touch with that. And on my own journey, I have been involved in kind of reclaiming it, because when I was 21 and my closest friend was killed in a car accident and I was feeling a sense of his presence, there was no known teaching out there that I could easily get access to. And so in a way, I had to write the book that I would have wanted to read when I was 21, my closest friend was killed in a car accident. Okay, now that's in advance of your question. So it turns out what I've discovered is afterlife is not a location. The normative Christian view is, well, you know, you're either going to get on an elevator and you're going to go up, or you're going to get on an elevator and you're going to go down. And it's understood very much as a location. I would go visit my son when he was living in Bloomington, Indiana, on the drive to the airport to Indianapolis, there was a sign that said, avoid hell, repent. And I always had to pull out my GPS to see that I wasn't going to make a wrong turn. So in the mystical Jewish model, which is really based on also tradition. Tradition and mysticism are not that far apart in some periods of time. Afterlife is not so much of a place one goes to, but rather a journey that one goes on. So while we're alive, we're an amalgam of body, emotion, mind, and spirit, right? You wouldn't disagree with that. You know, we have physical bodies, we have emotions, we have thoughts, and there's some other realm where we connect or have a sense of the mysteries of life and death and the universe. And in death, each of those parts, the body, consciousness separates from the body. There's a process of clearing out the unresolved emotional stuff. There's a kind of perception of the divine, and then there's emerging back with the divine. So in my work, I've described stages of the afterlife journey that are very comparable to what we find in Hinduism and in the Tibetan Book of the Dead and in other places. So the earliest part is leaving go of attachments to the body. There are spirits that stick around because they're not ready to leave go. Then eventually those spirits move on, and then there's what they call Gehenna in Jewish text. It's sort of like purgatory, a little bit hellish, but it's not eternal damnation. It's cleaning up all of the SH that's left under the rug. The Tibetans talk about the wrathful deities. You see somebody that has scary eyes and is about to devour you, and you realize it's a projection of your own mind. So we have all of these pieces of negativity, of loss, of grief, of hatred that we have to work through. Then there's visions like the heavenly descriptions of paradise and all that, but they're really metaphors of some exalted consciousness. And then there's a return back to the source of life, merging with the divine. That's as best as I can sort of present it in a nutshell.
Okay, so it's interesting. One is because it sounds very similar to, like you said, Hinduism, but it also Islamic faith as well. It sounds quite similar.
There's similarities. Look, all across the planet, they're just described in different cultural metaphors. But there seems to be some sense of when the body ends, there's some transitional journey that souls go on. And so the Hindus paint it in Hindu iconography, and the Buddhists paint it in Buddhist iconography, and it gets depicted with different kinds of imagery, but it may well be the same process that souls go through.
And in all of those, with Christianity being the outlier, it's not a particular, not a location, but this idea of being judged and living in a punishable place for eternity. So is there a concept of how you lived in this life on earth? Does that influence the afterlife at all, and actually your journey through the afterlife as you described it?
So basically you're asking me about this whole question of eternal damnation and judgment. So
yeah,
let me say this.
Yeah, and if,
yeah, go on.
If the acts of, and even in a positive life too, if the acts that we do here on earth, does that influence the journey of the afterlife?
Well, look, I think having studied religions across the planet, the notion that our actions have some kind of repercussion seems to be taught everywhere. The Hindus call it karma. We have the sense of judgment and we sort of freak out and say, oh my God, judgment, there's no judgment. But then we go to a yoga class and they talk about karma, meaning the fruits of our action, and we say, oh, that's very nice, let me say om. So we don't realize they're the same thing, and it seems to be that there is a universal law of cause and effect, that what we do does have implications not only in our living, but also in the accrued results that we encounter in our own death. Now, St. Augustine, who wrote City of God, said there's eternal damnation. But in Judaism, there is no eternal damnation. It's not so much of a process of punishment, though the metaphors are of punishment, but it's more of a process of cleansing. So the old metaphors, the medieval metaphors, look like a penal colony. Mm-hmm. You actually read some of the texts that talk about this process of Gehenna, and I call it a process rather than a location, and it looks like what might have been done in the punishments in the penal colony. Today, the new metaphor, one of my colleagues says, is not the penal colony, it's rehab. So the post-mortem journey has a period of rehab where you have to go in and you clean up all of the SH that's under the rug, and you encounter all of those places of guilt and of shame and of incompletion in your life. So one of the texts I study, one of the texts I teach says that the punishment in this post-mortem realm of Gehenna is people who sinned from their tongue, people who sinned from their tongue hang from their tongue, people who sinned from their genitals hang from their genitals. And I say, well, what would it be to look in the mirror and see all of the times that you shot from the lip and you were verbally abusive to people you loved that might feel like hanging from the tongue? What would it be to look in the mirror, do what they call in the fourth step, the fearless moral inventory, and see all of the times you acted with impropriety in your intimate relationships and you hurt someone else? It might feel like hanging from your So suddenly the images of torment are really metaphors of some kind of process of cleansing. And so, yeah, who is it that doesn't have some unresolved stuff when they die? Who is it that doesn't have a family member that you didn't say, I love you and I'm sorry to? Who is it that doesn't have some sense of, you know what, on that one, I screwed up and I could have done that better? So we're always in a process of self-betterment while we're alive. And my reading of the afterlife text is that there's a period of time where we have to continue to do that work that the Jews call tshuva, return, repentance, but it's really intentional self-betterment. And then you go on and you do other things. Then you go on and you harvest the highest spiritual potentialities that you've accrued in your also in your lifetime.
So in a way, they are meant as metaphors for direction in this life. They are a way to check the way in which we live now.
Well, certainly in Judaism, the rabbis used it very much like a carrot and a stick. Absolutely. There's a lot of teachings about, you want to avoid the torments of Gehenna, therefore go visit the sick and do your prayers and be kind to other people. Act morally and ethically in this lifetime, and you will reap the rewards of that. Boy, we sure can use that today.
Oh, boy, yeah. in more ways than one. I do think, though, that we do kind of gloss over. We are focused on the hyper ugly, I think. I wonder if if we actually, there is a lot of good being done out there that we're just not promoting. We as sort of the global us media.
I think that's the case, and just to keep it within the context of this conversation, the fundamentalist wants you to believe that heaven is a location and hell is a location. But when you see it as a spiritual awareness, that you're part of a spiritual path, the more we open up to transcendent awareness while we are alive, the more we open up to feeling our sense interwoven into the weave and the fabric of all universal life, into the cosmos itself. That's sort of how I call God. The more we open up to feeling that sense of connectedness with all human beings through what we refer to as love, the more we do that while we're alive, it may be that that as a reward, or that as a state of consciousness without the body, is what awaits for us.
And so to take that a step more, so I mean that's it sounded like now you sounded like the psychotherapist version of yourself. So what is that connection between the emotional and psychological states and the spiritual states? What's the connection between that and the belief in the afterlife, and then how does that manifest into the act of passing?
Well, the model or the awareness that I hold is, if I draw a circle, and on the left side of the circle, right, I draw it in half, and then on the left side I put birth, and on the other side I put death. So birth to death is only one half of the cycle of existence. The other half is from death through to rebirth. Birth through to death is one half of the cycle of existence, and death through to rebirth is the other half. So that means that for a time we're alive in bodies, and then in death, death is not simply the cessation of bodily life. Death is a transition to a state of consciousness without a body. And so one of the implications is that our work in companioning people who are dying is to help them be able to leave this world more gracefully, without regret, without fear. A lot of the religious texts talk about the moment of death is absolutely painless. There's one metaphor that uses, like taking hair out of milk. And
Taking hair out of milk?
Taking hair out of milk is pretty painless. If you have to reach in, there's actually a Talmudic text that uses that. The moment of death is actually painless, it was taking hair out of milk.
I guess it's visual.
You sort of like dip in and it's out of there. And so working with the dying, it's to help people make the transition more gracefully. And working with the bereaved, it's to help people realize that there is some continuity of connection with loved ones who have died. And through dreams or through some sense of felt connection, felt presence, or through meaningful coincidences and synchronicities, and people have all kinds of fascinating stories, there are ways in which those who have died still remain in some sense of connectedness to us.
I was talking during my conversations with, and I had heard this before, but in the conversation with a Buddhist chaplain on the same topic, she was telling me a few stories, and she said that it is very common that people in their adult life that have either strayed or just lost their faith, they come back to it quite vividly in the process of dying. Is that an experience that you see as well?
Are you referring to for people having apparitions of deceased family members on their deathbed?
No, just more like, so, you know, I was raised Christian as a child. I don't practice, but say if in the meantime I haven't filled that spirituality or faith with something else, and I'm lying on my deathbed, then I will embrace Christianity in those moments before I die.
Well, you know, they say there are no atheists in a foxhole. So I think in moments people open up to the mystery of it all. We live in a culture that is so deathophobic and so fear-filled in regard to death. And teachings about life after death help alleviate and transform that fear. My teacher, Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, when they asked him, and he was at 89, they asked him how he felt about his impending death. He said he was looking forward to his next redeployment. And I thought, wow, that would be an interesting way to have a whole culture live.
What you're saying, what I've heard it a couple times, Judaism believes that there is reincarnation?
From the 12th century onward in Judaism, reincarnation is normative. It disappears with the Enlightenment and with modernity, but it's pretty much hardwired into a lot of teachings from the 12th, 13th, 14th, 16th, into the 17th, 18th century, yes.
And then so it's you are, on the forefront of thought in reestablishing that belief? Because so at the beginning of the conversation, there's this idea of, what I've heard and what I assumed regarding there not being a belief in the afterlife. So this, we'll call it modern, but this the recent or post-Enlightenment, they just stopped believing in everything. It was just rational thought, no mysticism at all. And that's carried on into general modern thought.
Right, but we've moved beyond the modern age to the contemporary age. So in the last 25 years, there's really been a reclaiming of spirituality, not only within Judaism, but within Judaism there's a movement called Jewish Renewal that is renewing the spirituality of Judaism, not looking to reestablish it as it was in 18th century Poland, but really bringing to it modern feminist thinking and Gaia consciousness about ecology and the planet and social action, and reinfusing mystical ideas, mystical teachings into that contemporary awareness. So my work writing about Jewish views of the afterlife, I see myself as part of a broader reclaiming of a lot of these lost traditions about afterlife and angels and reincarnation and altered states of consciousness and all of that, that pretty much got lost for a good 150, 200 years. And so, yeah, I'm at the cutting edge, and I would guess I like to think of this work as moving from the fringe to the frontier.
I'm just amazed about the commonalities. And maybe this is a byproduct of the world in which we live too, where we're so us against them, and things are so easily consumed when they're segmented and distilled to whoever's doing the distilling, whatever form they like. But I said this earlier in our conversation. I'm just amazed, out of all the people that I have spoken with on this topic, just the similarities. I don't know why I thought there wouldn't be, but there's far more similarities than there are differences.
Well, let me say a couple of things to sort of start to wind down. The way I want to think about this whole area about the spirituality of the deathbed is in the following way. In the year 1900, Sigmund Freud published The Interpretation of Dreams. And he was very intentional about launching that in the new century that really begins cultural transformations of attitudes towards human sexuality. Certainly, Freud was very early in that, and look, it's 118 years later, and we've come a long way, but Lord knows we still have a long way to go in terms of cultural transformations of attitudes towards human sexuality. In 1969, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross publishes On Death and Dying, and that book symbolically and literally launches a process of cultural transformation of attitudes towards death and dying. And we're not even 50 years out of Kubler-Ross's initial impetus. So we're still in the early stages of a broader cultural transformation of attitudes towards death and dying. And the right to die movement and green burial and increasing interest in hospice and this podcast and these kinds of conversations are spreading incrementally in different pockets of the culture. And yes, and it's bringing in streams of teachings from great religious traditions around the world and indigenous traditions and shamanic traditions. And the New York Center for Contemplative Care is a Zen-based hospice project. And there's a lot of a kind of confluence of wisdom that is part of this greater impetus of transforming cultural attitudes towards death and dying. And so my piece is to work within Judaism, but to really see it as part of a greater transformation in the world. So that's one thing I want to say in sum. And the other piece I want to say is that when people ask me, do you believe in life after death? What I say is, I have a strong hunch between this world and the world beyond is a window and not a wall. Rationalist thinking, materialist thinking would have us believe that dead is dead, you pull the plug, you're out of here, there's no connection between the living and the dead. But these ancient traditions, the wisdom traditions that write about consciousness and survival after death, have a strong sense that between the world of the living and the world of the dead is a window and not a wall, and that window opens in moments of silent prayer and contemplation and dreams and meaningful coincidences, and so that there is this continuity of consciousness, and at some point those beings on the other side become intercessors or spirit guides and guide us in our lives and in our death. And people help us welcome us to the other side.
Well, that is a great way to summarize. I thank you for your time.
Great.
This has been amazing. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.